This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. This week, Cincinnati Council approved a city budget totaling nearly $1.6 billion for the fiscal year that starts July 1st. And the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority Board voted to put a tax levy on next year's ballot. And funeral services for Otto Warmbier were held yesterday. It's our weekly review of local news. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And joining us first is WVXU digital editor and reporter Tana Weingartner. Tana has been covering the retrial of former UC police officer Ray Tensing, which has gone into jury deliberations. And Tana, what's the latest today?
Well, we are on day five, and we haven't heard much from the jury all this week. They started deliberating Monday afternoon, but they did come back a little after 10 o'clock this morning and told the judge that they were deadlocked. Now, the judge then read them either the Allen charge or what we have in Ohio called the Howard charge, which basically tells them that there will never be any better evidence than there was in this trial, and there will never be a jury that's better suited to decide this case, and she sent them back to continue their deliberations. So yeah. That happened after about 27 hours of deliberating. So what I know right now is I saw some lunch get delivered a little while ago, so we've been told they've worked through lunch this week, so we presume that their talks continue right now.
So the Allen charges or the Howard charges just basically just encouraging them to keep trying to reach a verdict of some type?
Correct.
Now, how does this compare to the first trial, Tana? They went for what? Was it about 25 hours before they came out and said they were deadlocked and couldn't reach a decision?
At 16 hours, roughly, in the last trial is when they came for the first time and said that they were deadlocked. And that's the point at which they received either the Allen charge, which is, I believe, the federal charge. In Ohio, we have a slightly different version called the Howard charge. We're not entirely certain which one was read today. But in the last trial, after about 16 hours was when they said they were deadlocked for the first time. And then at 25 hours is when Judge Shanahan, who was overseeing the case at the time, declared the mistrial.
Have you been able to gauge a mood in the courthouse from the DeBose family or the Tensing family on this?
You know, everybody just is kind of waiting. I haven't seen the DeBose family this morning. However, I've been kind of stuck, for lack of a better word, in the media room. I presume that they could be around somewhere. You know, they're just lots of waiting.
Any idea how long Judge Leslie Gibbs might let them keep going before she finally accepts that they're deadlocked?
You know, anything that I would be, any type of number I would give you would be pure speculation on my part. I wouldn't think she would want them to go into what you would think the jurors wouldn't want to go into the weekend. But again, this is a very serious case, and their work is very serious. So that would be pure speculation.
Yeah. And if it is another hung jury, Tana, do we know will we find out how the jurors voted? Do they release that information at some point?
I think that would probably fall to the prosecutor's office, to Joe Dieters. And, you know, we got some conflicting numbers from him last time following the first trial. So we just don't know at this point if he would release that information.
And so as you're saying it, the wait continues.
Yeah. What I'm saying is I know a whole lot of nothing at this point, Mark.
Well, Tana, you know a lot more than we do. Thank you for filling us in. It sounds like this is another tough decision for the jury to make. So Tana Weingartner, WVXU digital editor and reporter, and joining us now for our Friday news review to discuss the top stories of the week are WCPO.com Managing Editor Opinion and Engagement David Holthouse, Cincinnati Business Courier Staff Reporter and Columnist Chris Wederick, and WVXU Reporter Ann Thompson. Again, you can join us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ann, you covered the funeral yesterday for Otto Warmbier, the Wyoming grad who came back from North Korea after being imprisoned there for over a year and came back in a coma, passed away earlier this week. What was it like yesterday at the funeral? That was held at Wyoming High School, right?
It was very somber. There were thousands of people who came, and the funeral was scheduled to start at 9. I'm not really sure if it started on time or not. I think it was a little bit late because there were so many people. And the funeral was held in the auditorium of Wyoming High School, which only holds about 800, but they had overflow areas in the cafeteria and the gym. So the people who couldn't fit in the auditorium then watched it on a monitor. And then there were so many people that they were those who couldn't even get in the school, and they were had to wait outside.
So a couple thousand people attended the funeral, yeah. What were their memories of Otto? What kinds of things were they saying about him?
Well, they were saying some great things, as you can imagine. So, you know, I talked to a guy whose name is David Weinrich, and he went to school and was in the graduating class as Otto. And he just says he was amazing. He was nice to everybody. He'd come up to anybody and talk to them no matter who you were, and always had a smile on his face. And he had people laughing, and he was athletic and smart, and he was such an amazing person. So we got lots of comments like that. Then there was a woman, Betty Waite, who happened to be Warren Beer's kindergarten soccer coach. And so, and her son is also in Warren Beer's graduating class. And so she was at the graduation, and she said she sat there and listened to his salutatorian speech and thought, this kid is going somewhere. And she said, it's such a tragic loss to the entire universe that this happened.
Yeah. Now, North Korea put out a statement today about this. What did they say?
This is the first time that North Korea has responded, and through their official Korean Central News Agency was just a denial that it cruelly treated or tortured Otto Warmbier, who was detained there for about 17 months and then, as you mentioned, died this week. But when he was released, then he was in a coma. And it turns out shortly after his sentence of 15 years hard labor, something happened and he was in a coma for much of that time.
Mm-hmm. So they're basically saying it's a mystery to them. They don't know what
they're saying. It's not our fault. And we said what it was earlier, botulism and a sleeping pill, and he didn't wake up.
So is anybody looking further into what happened to Otto Warmbier? Is the coroner looking into this
anymore? So this week, we heard that the Hamilton County coroner was looking into it. However, the family has decided that they did not want to have an autopsy. So really, the only thing that the coroner was looking at was just the body externally, and she was looking at the various medical records and the MRIs, and she could not reach a conclusion. However, she said that she had other people to interview and other records to examine, so it was just kind of left open at this point.
What's the family had to say since Otto Warmbier passed away?
So they put out a statement, and they were saying, you know, a number of things. For example, they said that when he was returned here June the 13th, he was unable to speak, unable to see, and unable to react to verbal commands. He looked very uncomfortable, almost anguished, they say. And they said, although we would never hear his voice again, within a day, the countenance of his face changed, and he was at peace. And he was at home, and we believe he could sense that. They also said that, you know, it would be easy in a moment like this to focus on all that we lost. The future time that won't be spent with a warm, engaging, brilliant young man whose curiosity and enthusiasm for life knew no bounds. But we choose to focus on the time that we were given to be with this remarkable person, they say. And you can tell from the outpouring of emotion from the communities that he touched that the love for Otto went well beyond his immediate family.
Now, did you know, Van, are they planning any other memorials or events for Otto Warmbier in Wyoming?
They may be, but I don't know that. You probably saw pictures of the ribbons draped around the trees, and there was a real solidarity throughout the time that he was over there. Although nobody was really talking, they were concerned of what might happen to him and were told not to say anything. But just coming back to the funeral, that there were, you know, plenty of students, former teachers, and just you know, students hugging and crying and just so they can't even believe that something like this would happen.
Now, Senator Rob Portman was at the funeral. What did he have to say?
He was, and he spoke before the funeral, and he was just saying that North Korea needs to be held accountable for what happened, and they have shown that they not only don't have regard for the rule of law, the Geneva Convention, the basic freedoms that we enjoy, but they've shown through their treatment of Otto a disregard for basic human rights, for human dignity. And Senator Portman said that the next step needs to be a tightening sanctions for North Korea.
Any talk of of just banning travel to North Korea by Americans?
Well, there has been talk about that. In fact, Senator John McCain was just saying that if you go over there, then you're just stupid, and that there was some push to try to say, well, you know, if you go over there, you're on your own. The government's not going to come get you. But no, nothing official yet. And there's been some criticism of Pioneer Tours that was the tour that he went on, although they claim this was the only incident ever that there's been a problem.
Well, and since then, haven't they backed away, too, from taking people on tours?
Americans.
Okay.
They banned Americans. And then one other thing that I'll say, the BBC interviewed the person who roomed with Otto while he was on this trip. It was a British man. And he said he was twice Otto's age, but again, was, you know, only positive things, like very engaging. And he was just saying that it didn't seem to be in his personality to, although he doesn't know for sure, take any poster down. But as Otto was being led away, and the guy said this is going to haunt him forever, he just kind of joked and with Otto and said, well, this will be the last time we see you.
Oh, my gosh.
And they both laughed about it because it was just kind of, they thought it was a momentary thing. He'd be back in 5 minutes. And then
it turned out to be true.
Yeah.
Anne, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
WVXU reporter Anne Thompson. And we will continue our review of local news. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news. And joining us this afternoon, WCPO.com Managing Editor David Holthouse, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, and WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Cincinnati Council this week approved a nearly $1.6 billion city budget, which is going to take effect on July 1st. So, Chris, what's in this particular budget?
All kinds of things. you know, the city council spent, you know, they spent a lot of time. It was an interesting budget process because they ended up basically doing the kind of horse trading that you typically expect to be done behind closed doors. They did that kind of out in the open in front of people at a couple of budget committee hearings earlier this week. You know, there was not a lot of controversy over this budget. It was an election year budget, so they wanted to do everything they could to not cut any kind of services that people would notice, particularly closing pools, fire, police, those types of things that citizens really kind of care about. You know, the points of contention as things kind of close down, there's about, you know, maybe $6 or $7 million in spending that they kind of negotiated over. They added, you know, for example, $350,000 in human services spending. They added they took $500,000 from a plan to replace police and fire vehicles and to pave streets. And they use that to try to enhance some pedestrian safety in some neighborhoods. There have been a lot of neighborhoods who have been complaining about speeding cars through their business districts, some dangerous situations. So they're going to try to use that money to enhance safety by, you know, installing LED sidewalks that light up when people cross so that drivers will see clearly that somebody is crossing the street. So they're going to do some things like that. It was a kind of a contentious process near the end. There were some definite politics involved as well with the impending mayoral race between Yvette Simpson, who's a council member, and of course incumbent Mayor John Cranley.
So how is this going to impact the mayoral election?
You know, it was interesting because council member Simpson voted no on the budget, and she had a number of reasons for doing that she described. One was she feels like the budget, of course, started out with a $26 million deficit, and they managed to close that in a number of ways. Basically, they put a lot of spending that typically goes from the general fund, the city's main checkbook. They moved that to other funds, such as the stormwater fund. And she thinks that really that, you know, that's a problem in the future because the stormwater fund is you know, really going to need some capital improvements. We've had a lot of 100-year floods. We've had some bad floods recently. And she believes that that was probably unwise, and that the administration needs to restructure itself to basically be cheaper over the long term and to be more structurally balanced. The mayor's office says that, of course, that's nonsense, and that Councilmember Simpson didn't really point out what she would cut. They feel that she should have introduced her own comprehensive spending plan. She said, there's no way I could do that. I had 15 days to submit my changes once I saw the mayor's final budget. And, you know, that's just, that's not something that's really possible. So you saw this back and forth between the two of them. And, you know, expect to hear more about that during the campaign.
Yeah. One of the things that that made it into the budget was funding for the needle exchange program
mm-hmm.
that's based at UC. And David, I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the program, I believe, was funded through a grant, mostly through grant money, which had expired. I don't believe it's additional funding for needle exchange, but replacement funding for some private grant money that was used to operate that program. It's a mobile program. I think there's three sites in Cincinnati where it goes, you know, it needs to happen. And with a drug epidemic the way it is now, there's been increases in hepatitis C and HIV through injection drug use. So really, it's a way to kind of minimize the sort of other damage that can come about through injection drug use.
Mm-hmm. Bill, what are some of the things that didn't make it in this budget? I think the booting, for instance, that didn't make it in.
I don't believe so.
Yeah. The mayor vetoed an ordinance today. Basically, what they did a strange thing where they. And I'm going to trip over explaining this a little bit, but let me try to simplify it. They had a plan to basically get about $400,000 from booting vehicles whose owners had not paid their parking tickets. And what they did was they eliminated that funding and took some funding from somewhere else. Well, that put the budget out of structural balance. So what the mayor did today was he vetoed that ordinance and pledged to basically make it so that the budget is structurally balanced in the future. Or in this year, the current year. And so there's some kind of financial maneuvering there. That was kind of the theme of the whole thing was
– There was a lot of financial maneuvering to get this budget in place, wasn't
it? This budget is put together with toothpicks and duct tape, and they're going to face another $20 million deficit next year. That's the estimate right now from the city manager's office. It could go higher than that. And so next year, you know, I mean, we started out this year talking about closing pools. That obviously didn't happen. They did all kinds of financial maneuvering to make sure this thing balanced. And they're going to have a lot of difficulty, I think, next year as well doing it. You know, the city manager has kind of indicated that you know, this is the end of the road for that type of stuff. You know, you can only, you know, that, for example, you know, one of the things to really kind of illustrate this, you know, they replace those kind of near sewers where they had the covers on the sewers, they replaced those typically out of the public works budget. Well, because it's on a sewer and it's involved in some kind of sewer, they can take that expense and put that on the stormwater budget, which is paid for by ratepayers. So it's different. It's a different funding source. So I think that they're going to basically run out of ways to shift that spending around. And so that's something that, you know, that they're going to have a problem with next year.
And the booting, I think, was supposed to raise, about $600,000? Is that right, Bill?
Yeah, $600,000.
Okay, yeah, about $600,000. So, you know, and that's in a $1.6 billion budget, that's chump change. That's not a huge expense. But there's all kinds of little things that they did to make this thing fly. And, you know, I think they're going to have a pretty rough time next year.
Did raising the parking rates, did that – Make
yes.
it through? Okay.
Yes. The parking rates, that was another thing that Councilmember Simpson cited as a problem. They doubled the parking rates around the University of Cincinnati. They'll be $1 per hour. Right now, they're 50 cents per hour. In other city neighborhoods, they'll go from 50 cents to 75 cents per hour. And she believes that, you know, that could hurt small businesses who don't want to see parking rates go up, because people can get some of those same services. They can go shop at Rookwood where they don't have to pay for parking at all. They can go eat over there. So that was her reason for voting no on that. The mayor's office, well, not the mayor's office, but some of the mayor's supporters countered by saying, well, look, you know, parking rates, if you raise them and if you, you know, adjust them to, you know, to encourage turnover, that can help small businesses by making people not park somewhere for 3 hours at 50 cents an hour, and it will get turnover in front of your business and bring more customers in. So there's a, it's kind of a debate about parking throughout the whole budget that was kind of, you know, kind of ongoing. So not sure who's right about that, but that's, those are the two theories.
But some of the rates in some of the neighborhoods are going up then.
They are, and they will, and there's additional rate increases downtown and over the Rhine as well, where parking is already, you know, it depends where it is. And the most expensive part of downtown, I believe it will be $2.75 an hour, up about a quarter. The parking rates downtown and over the Rhine aren't going to increase as much as they did a few years ago when they increased them to pay for some of the streetcar operations.
How did the economic development groups, how did they fare in this particular budget?
They dodged a bullet. They were kind of on the chopping block in the city manager's initial budget, and then the mayor restored funding for them. Councilmember Simpson proposed 10% cuts to them to fund some of her priorities. The rest of the council liked the idea of funding human services, which is what she wanted to do. So they looked for another source to pay for that. Again, they went to a fund. They went to a couple of funds that are just kind of, you know, where money was kind of laying around. And they did a lot of this, like I said. They moved money from one fund to another to make sure all the eligible expenses lined up and made room for this, for this funding. So they dodged a bullet, and you know, they will have their full allocation. They won't get an increase, but they'll basically have the same amount of money that they had last year. We're talking about groups like Ready Cincinnati, which is involved in attracting companies to the region, the Port Authority, which is involved in clearing brownfields and preparing sites.
3CDC is part of that, isn't it?
Yeah, 3CDC, they're getting a lot of money in this budget because they run and program both Fountain Square and the new Ziegler Park. They also have a couple of parking garages. Well, not more than a couple. They have parking garages. So they do a lot of programming that, for example, Councilmember Sittenfeld didn't really, you know, want to see them cut because he thinks that they're involved, you know, deeply in, and they are, in the vibrancy of the city.
How did the streetcar had some operating funds passed too? Was that part of this budget, or was that something separate, Chris?
The streetcar budget is separate from the rest of the budget. It has its own ordinance. There was some controversy and some hand-wringing over that. It ended up clearing the council. Councilmember Kevin Flynn wrote a budget for them that had some cuts to things like marketing and some other line items. It was less, and I can't remember the exact figure. I believe it was in the $4.4 million range. So he ended up cutting, I think, about in the neighborhood of about $200,000 from what the city and SORTA is, of course, the agency that oversees the streetcars operations. He cut about $200,000 from what they had proposed. We're not clear yet whether SORTA is okay with that.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what does that mean for streetcar operations?
Kevin Flynn assured all of us that people who ride the streetcar will see no difference. And, you know, your marketing budget doesn't, of course, improve user experience, but it does potentially increase the number of users. The streetcar really has very little marketing budget, and I know that it's something that the CEO of Cincinnati Bell, Ted Torbeck, who's running a committee to try to make the streetcar work better. You know, I think that committee wanted to see a little bit more marketing support for the streetcar to make people aware of it when they're downtown, and you know, make sure people are aware of, you know, what it does and where it goes and what it's designed to do. So, you know, I think that they're concerned about that. Again, though, this is a budget that spans fiscal years. So we're going to have a new city council for probably about half of this budget, and potentially a new mayor, depending on the result of the Simpson-Cranley race. So all of this stuff that we're talking about could be subject to change if we had, you know, get significantly different council members or we have a new mayor.
Now, the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority, they're going to ask Hamilton County voters to approve a sales tax next year, and the money would be used for the Metro bus service. It wouldn't be used for the streetcar.
Correct. They made no bones about that Tuesday night, I believe it was. They emphasized that no money from any sales tax would go toward streetcar operations. It would just be for the bus service.
So what are they talking about here, Bill, in terms of do they have an exact amount set for what they're going to ask for?
No. They
don't.
They had a task force who looked at this issue and said, well, you could do a half cent, you could do 0.75 cents, or a full cent. We'll leave it up to you. And the sort of board says, okay, we'll think about that. We are going to do it. They voted unanimously to put this on the ballot next year. They thought about doing it this year, but thought that's not really going to give us enough time to educate voters, to persuade people that this is necessary and let everyone know what we'd be using that money for. So they're going to wait and do it next year.
So they're looking at a half cent, a 0.75 cents, or a full cent, but they don't know yet. I guess they're going to get a lot of public input before they make that final decision.
That's what they said, yeah. They'll have some public hearings. They'll find out what is likely to pass, probably.
You know, Sorta's levy is another thing that could be affected by the election big time, because I believe there are, I think, more than two-thirds, maybe three-fourths of the members are, their terms are going to expire. You have a lot of members that were appointed by the previous Republican-controlled county commission. The county commission, of course, now is controlled by two Democrats. So those members, some of whom are Tea Party folks, very anti-tax people, those members could end up changing. And again, a bunch of them are appointed. The city, of course, has a majority on this board. The mayor appoints people to Sorta as well. And so, again, if you get a new mayor, you could potentially have new Sorta board members. So they could decide to throw out the whole levy, or they could decide, you know, to take a different approach, wait a year. I think that the current leadership on the Sorta board feels that 2018 is a good year to go, particularly given the backlash against President Trump could bring out some more progressive liberal voters. The Democrats, of course, won this county in 2016, and in 2018 could be a similar situation. So a lot of moving parts to that Sorta levy before it actually happens.
Is Sorta spending money on the streetcar that would otherwise be available for the bus system bill?
No, they're completely separate.
Okay, two separate things. If it goes up a penny, what would that make the sales tax in the county? What are we at now? Is it seven?
We're at seven. It would be eight, I believe.
Okay.
Or maybe it's 6.75 and we'll be at 7.75. It's one of those two. The state has raised the sales tax across the state so that it has gone up in the county because of state government, not because of county government. It's gone up in the last couple of years.
So, Bill, how is Metro funded right now?
Largely through the city's earnings tax. They get a big chunk of money through that, and Metro serves the entire county. So their argument is, well, why is the city paying for all of this when the county gets a lot of benefit from it? And, you know, other counties too. Claremont County gets a little bit of benefit. Butler County, maybe do they go up into Warren County?
They do.
Kings Island.
All three of those counties, they have federal money for transit, and they contribute that to Sorta to run some of it, to Sorta to run those commuter buses. Those are almost entirely paid for by that federal grant. None of those counties have local funding for transit whatsoever.
So would the sales tax, would that replace the earnings tax?
That's the idea. That's okay. The idea. They go to the city and say, okay, this is passed. You don't need to give us the big chunk of the earnings tax anymore.
We have a comment on Facebook from Robert who says that Sorta should charge higher fares.
Well, that may be coming too. One of the things they're going to do in this next year is they're going to make some cuts, see about phasing out some inefficient bus lines, and they are going to go to the city council and say, hey, before we ask for this sales tax, can you allow us to raise rates? Can you allow us to raise our fares? Which could hurt them at the ballot box next November.
The other thing that raising fares does, this is kind of a popular idea amongst people who don't want the sales tax, but what it does is it cannibalizes your ridership. It makes it so, believe it or not, you know, another 25 cents on top of a $1.75 fare, that can make or break some people. And it can, you know, so they end up not riding the bus at all. They might lose their job, et cetera, et cetera. So the research on this shows that the higher you raise fares, the kind of you lose, you know, you end up losing some riders and you lose some revenue sometimes as well. So it does raise a little bit more revenue, but it doesn't cover the gap, the budget gap that Sorta has.
What is that budget gap?
You really need to separate it into their operating deficit versus their capital deficit. Their capital deficit is significant. When you add it on all together, I believe they said $260 million, Bill, something like that. It's in the hundreds of millions over a long period of time because of the older buses that they have. The operating deficit, you know, their day-to-day, you know, running the buses, paying the bus drivers, paying the maintenance people, that's in the low single millions, depending on which year we're talking about. I think it was about $2 million in the last year or something like that.
Have they done any studies? You're talking about the impact that this would have if they raised fares on people. Have they done any studies of the impact on businesses if they raise the sales tax? Because if it goes up to almost 8%, Warren and Claremont counties, for example, their sales tax is at 6.75%.
Right. They have those numbers. I don't know that they've done a study to say, you know, people will go to Warren County to shop. I mean, clearly clearly some people will, especially those who live on the border with either the outlying counties or Northern Kentucky. One thing that's important to mention on this is that Mayor Cranley supports a half-cent sales tax and then would do away completely with the earnings tax. Councilmember Simpson hasn't laid out a plan in as much detail as the mayor has. I know that she is skeptical about getting rid of the earnings tax for transit. She's also talked about a concept where people in cities within Hamilton County opt in to SORTA and they either pay some of their general fund towards expansion or they, you know, raise a similar transit earnings tax like the city of Cincinnati does. So we haven't seen, a detailed plan from her as much as the mayor. And one thing important to note about the mayor's plan is SORTA believes that a half cent is inadequate.
Would that really cover the gap they're facing?
It would raise, they get about $50 million a year from the city. If they raised a half cent and got rid of the earnings tax, they'd get about $75 million, roughly, maybe closer to 70, between 70 and $75 million in local funding from that sales tax. So it would almost increase their share by about 50%. But SORTA is looking over the next 10 years, and they don't believe the sales tax will grow that much in the out years of that tax, and they'll face a continual problem. Cranley's argument is, hey, look, I'm proposing to increase your funding by 50%. That's pretty good, isn't it? And so that's kind of one of the battle lines that's going to be drawn and have to be discussed next year year.
And we will continue our discussion. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news. Joining us this afternoon, WCPO.com Managing Editor David Holthouse and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wedrick. And you can join our conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. David, at WCPO.com, there was a story this week about how in Middletown, in light of the cost of providing Narcan, there is a city council member who's raising some questions about if it's possible for city emergency services not to respond to overdose victims. But I think the story says that Middletown's on track to spend about $100,000 on Narcan, which is the overdose antidote.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the cost is going up and up for cities and first responding agencies all over the state, all over the country, as more and more people are overdosing. And there is a sense of frustration that, number one, it's getting more expensive. Number two, we keep seeing the same people overdosing. And I've heard this also from first responders and police who are just suffering from fatigue, really. They'll rescue someone, more than one time in a single day, and they wonder, why are we doing this?
It has to be discouraging to see the same person overdose again a few days later. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. If you compare it to, say, car accidents, if someone's drunk driving too fast, driving recklessly, those people have made choices to do that. And if they get into an accident, they will be rescued despite the fact that they may have made some bad choices. So, it's really similar with heroin use and other drug abuse. these people's lives deserve to be saved. So, but it is a question that a lot of people are wrestling with right now.
That's shocking. So he doesn't want, the council member doesn't, like, how would you pick and choose? Like, would you look at the address and be like, I've been there once today, I'm not going back?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's like David was saying, people are asking the question. You keep seeing the same people overdosing, and you just wonder how much can we afford to keep dealing with this problem. But at the same time, I think the fire chief in Middletown, his response was pretty good, that morally and legally, that you just can't not respond to people who are caught up in this
right,
whole thing.
Right. It's a symptom of our society today that really we need to deal with. And it's, you know, overwhelming a lot of institutions like, you know, police agencies, fire agencies and so forth, the coroner's office, hospitals, health departments. But yeah, in terms of rescuing, I think, yes, we do have a obligation to do that. And we'll, you know, they will rescue people who have had heart attacks from a lifetime of, you know, poor food choices, or who have, you know, passed out from drinking too much. So there's really no difference there, even though this heroin epidemic has grown so much. There has to be a way to deal with it other than saying we're not going to rescue you.
What's in terms of what's happening with the opioid crisis? Are we in kind of a lull right now, or are we getting to a point where things are starting to pick up again?
I think the from what I've been hearing from the coroner's office and health agencies, the overdose rate this year is on pace to be another record year, more than, you know, more so than last year, which was, I think, in Ohio was roughly, I'm going to say, a 25 to 30% increase from the year before. So it's on track to grow by double digits again this year. So, you know, the overdoses are still occurring. There's new types of drugs in the stream, fentanyl and carfentanil and different analogs of those, which are very fatal. So it's evolving like that, but for the worse, really.
Yeah. Now, one of the other things that you've had going on at WCPO.com is that you've asked that Governor Kasich declare this as an emergency.
Right.
What would that declaration do?
Well, I think it would give the governor the power and the authority to spend money without legislative action and do it quickly. One thing he could do would be to fund Narcan for all the first responding agencies in the state.
So that you wouldn't have a Middletown City Councilman asking the question, can we afford to keep
exactly.
spending all this money?
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. So that would be one thing they could do. There's other things that he could do. I mean, the governor has considerable power under an emergency order. He could step up highway patrol enforcement. I think the biggest thing would be that the state could step up as an agency that is coordinating the response around Ohio. And right now you have all these communities trying to fight this and fund it. If the state could step in and coordinate and identify best practices and lead a coordinated response around the state, I think that would be helpful. So that's another thing he could do under an emergency order.
Now, there are some states where they've actually done this, where they've actually declared an emergency around the
opioid there's, I think,
crisis.
Five states, Massachusetts, Alaska, Virginia, Maryland, have all declared an emergency. Florida was the latest one. And Ohio's situation is worse than all of those in terms of fatalities, not only the raw number of fatalities, but the death rate. So when you see a governor like Rick Scott in Florida, who's a conservative Republican, declaring an emergency, you wonder why it can't be done here when we have a situation that's even worse.
Has Governor Kasich said why he's not done this yet?
Well, he has claimed that they are treating it as an emergency and that they have already spent quite a bit of money on the problem. The fact is, though, that the money they are claiming to have spent, which is $1 billion, is really normal operational funding for a lot of the mental health agencies around the state. It's not new or additional funding to fight this problem specifically. So In one sense, yes, they have spent a lot of money, but in another sense, they really could be doing a lot more. And the state is sitting on a budget surplus of over $2 billion, so it's not like the state is revenue poor.
Yeah. Do you think at some point the governor will declare a state of emergency on this?
You know, I don't know. Do you
have any feel?
I just think that he's not going to do this. It just seems to be stubbornly insisting that we can handle it this way. Meanwhile, the death rate continues to go up and up. So at some point, we can't keep doing what we've been doing because it's not working. I don't know when he may realize that, but it's pretty evident, I think.
Now, this week, I believe it was this week, Amazon announced it's buying Whole Foods, or was that late last week?
It all runs together.
It all runs together. what I'm wondering about is the impact on Kroger.
Well, it's a major concern for them,
yeah,
because now Amazon has a, you know, they have a brick and mortar, they have a company with brick and mortar stores that they can not only distribute their, you know, potentially the groceries through, but other stuff as well. And, you know, grocery is potentially a huge business for Amazon coming on because more and more, I mean, people love, you know, there's a time I think when people were like, what, you're going to deliver clothes to my house? Why, I can't try them on then. You know, that it seemed crazy. But today, you know, you have so many retailers, yeah, brick and mortar retailers, Macy's being one of them, kind of on their heels because of online shopping. And so this is another industry poised for disruption, the grocery industry. And, you know, you've seen Kroger do some things to try to meet that. They have the click list delivery service where you drive to the store and you know, they have your groceries ready for you. They are looking at, I think they're looking at delivery in other markets as well. So it's definitely kind of a full frontal assault on traditional grocers, the purchase that Amazon has made. Going to need to drive prices down at Whole Foods a little bit, I think, before people, average people are going to buy their stuff from there. But it's definitely going to give them a pretty significant toehold in the grocery business.
Yeah, I think Whole Foods has, what, 400 stores around the country?
And I mean, it's not as huge as
Kroger. Not as big as Kroger.
Not as big, but I mean, it's clearly given them a foothold. I mean, there is some speculation at one point that maybe Kroger was a good Amazon target. I mean, they certainly have the money to make these kinds of big purchases.
Now, this isn't the first time that the Kroger's faced a challenge like this.
Absolutely.
When Walmart came into the market, what was that, back in with groceries?
Right. I mean, I think everybody—
Back in the early 2000s, I think, is when they first did that.
That's another thing where I think everybody thought Walmart could eat Kroger's lunch because of their advantage on pricing, and Kroger was able to match it. And shopping in a Kroger store is still a way more pleasant experience, I think, than shopping in Walmart.
Yeah, exactly. Our Dan Monk reported that Kroger has grown its market share for 11 straight years, even with the competitiveness. And grocery has always been a very competitive business. So you probably will see Kroger step up its online offerings. But I tried it, and I still like going to the store and picking up things and looking around. And
I still don't buy clothes online really either, so I'm an outlier.
Yeah, I just got to the point where I'm used to buying things like that online.
Yeah.
It's a bigger jump, I think, to buy my food. Like you're saying, I like to be able to see it.
Right.
And if it's produce, I like to be able to take a look at it and make sure I'm getting a good piece of fruit or a good vegetable.
So, you know, I've actually tried Amazon's before they bought Whole Foods. I've had them deliver groceries, and you know, it was fine. I mean, I bought a bunch of packaged goods. I got a giant carton of Goldfish crackers. I mean, it was great. But at the same time, you know, there's an interesting situation where you have to get the free delivery, you have to buy so many of a certain type, and it just became too complicated. And I suspect being Amazon, they're going to streamline that and make it a lot easier. So, you know, it's an interesting experience, and you could see, buying your Cheerios and some other things that aren't perishable from Amazon, but I suspect people want to get their fresh food from the grocery store still.
Yeah, it might be good for shoppers. Probably will be in the short term anyway with price cuts on some things. So ultimately, we'll see how that shakes out, but I think consumers may benefit somewhat at first.
Yeah. Anyway.
Chris, you also reported today on the last hurdle for the downtown Kroger store that they've—
No, first hurdle.
First hurdle.
First hurdle.
First hurdle.
There's many more to come.
Many more to come, but they've made some another step toward that.
Yeah, if you go to CincinnatiBusinessCourier.com, you'll just find a story about the first hurdle they had to do, which was they sold an alleyway between or they vacated is the correct term, an alleyway between the Hamilton County Commission building and the Kroger, the downtown Kroger site. It's the first, the first ordinance that they need to do in order to make that big 18-story tower and Kroger store go forward. It's a relatively easy vote. There's going to be some more votes in the coming weeks and months. The city still has to contribute its $8 million plus to the project and make some other changes around the zoning and everything to that, not zoning, but some final plans and whatnot in order to make that thing go forward. I think it's going to be a pretty smooth ride for that project through the city council, just because it has been long, long coveted.
People have been saying, we need this, we need this, we need this. So it's hard to imagine anybody now saying, no, we don't need it.
Right, right. One thing the Planning Commission also did this morning was they approved the regulation needed to allow medical marijuana cultivation in manufacturing zones within the city. There is the folks who own Rheingeist in a separate business want to open a medical marijuana cultivation plant in Camp Washington at the old Conn's meatpacking plant. And so they got approval from the Planning Commission today on that as well. That'll go through City Council as well. Seems like there's a lot of support for that, hoping to kind of get a toehold into that business, the medical marijuana business, which the legislature legalized, I believe it was in 2016.
Yeah. So what else would they have to do beyond what you just mentioned? Do they need state approval or do they need
they to will. Kind of get so licensing? So the state will award, I believe, 12 licenses across the state to operate these facilities. And so they will apply for one of them. It'll be up to the state who gets it. The city needs to send a letter of support with it. It looks like that's all going to happen. The interesting thing that I didn't realize about the medical marijuana cultivation centers is they're all indoors. You won't drive down Spring Grove Avenue and see a bunch of marijuana plants out in a field. It'll be all in a warehouse type of situation with grow lights and stuff like that. So, they want to keep it out of sight publicly, and they certainly don't want anybody hopping over a fence to pick it up.
And just a reminder that work is going to start on the Brent Spence Bridge tonight. Hooray, at 9 o'clock. It's going to continue through the summer. So are we all going to alter our routes for a few months?
I'm glad you brought it up. I think it's going to be really interesting to see because the Inquirer's headline was, traffic disaster coming. Well, we've had the Lytle Tunnel closed for I don't know how long. It's been at least a year. And we haven't had a traffic disaster. And what a lot of studies find is that when the places traffic normally flows through are shut off, people either don't take the trip or they find another way.
Yeah.
And it's not quite the disaster they expect. So I'll be interested to see if OKI is studying these wait times to see, exactly how bad it is.
I know David can't wait for this work.
Maybe this would be kind of a test for if and when tolls happen on the Brent Spence. How do we get around that?
Totally.
What are the alternative routes?
Totally.
Chris and David, thanks so much.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
WCPO.com Managing Editor David Holthouse and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick.